Please welcome in our new sponsor, Underdog Fantasy. Go to underdogfantasy.com and you'll discover that Underdog Fantasy is the best and easiest place to play fantasy sports. Underdog Fantasy lets you draft a fantasy dream team in minutes. Sign up now with the code POWERTRIP and you'll double your first deposit up to $100 in bonus cash when you make your first deposit of $10 or more. That's right, deposit $100 and get $100 for free. Underdog keeps it simple with their easy-to-use website and mobile apps. Pick between 2 and 5 players to fill out your pick'em slip, get every pick right, and take home some cold, hard cash. Use that promo code POWERTRIP and get your first deposit doubled up by $100 by Underdog. That's underdogfantasy.com. Use the promo code POWERTRIP today.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
What's up, guys? It's the phenomenal AJ Styles. You're listening to the two-man power trip.
Hey, Johnny. Cool, man. What's going on? We ready to go or what?
Welcome to the two-man power trip of wrestling. I'm your host, JP John Posworth. With me today, a very special guest, a sportscaster, an interviewer, an anchor. He used to work, of course, for the World Wrestling Federation in the late 80s. He was an announcer, an interviewer. He did it all, Mr. Craig DeGeorge. Craig, welcome to the two-man power trip. How are you doing?
Hey, John, good to be on the show. Yeah, great.
What's going on in your world? What have you been up to?
Well, I do down here in Florida. Been down here for a while, and I do the Marlins games on television, Major League Baseball. I do the hockey games as well. A lot of things over the years. Worked for NBC. Did some Notre Dame football. I worked did the XFL. I worked with Vince McMahon actually a few times. I did not only the WWF for him for a few years, which was a lot of fun, but I also came back and did the XFL. I did play by play on that in the first run. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Man, the XFL is back now, too, under a different regime, under the Rock. But it's funny, the XFL is back.
Excuse me. Yes, it brings tremendous emotion. Yes. Yeah, the XFL is back. And, it was great for me, and I had a lot of fun with it. Got to do some NBC events and then worked with Bob Golic on the games and the playoffs. And it really should have went another year. It was finding its footing toward the end of that year. At one point, Sports Illustrated wondered if it would challenge the NFL. To say that's the kind of reverence it had. They got off to a tough start because the offensive lines really weren't ready to go. But it was a lot of fun for all of us that worked on it.
So as far as you, I know obviously the sports field is what you're doing now. But rewinding back to the WWF days, I'm like curious, like how did you kind of get in? I know it's 1987, but how'd you get into the world of wrestling and WWF?
Well, like most kids, I watched a lot of the WWF back in the day. On Channel 9, if you grew up in the New York City area, which is where I grew up, and watched Vince McMahon, and obviously Vince Sr. had they were territories and so on. So I was very familiar with it. It was sort of can't miss, watch Bruno Sammartino on a Saturday morning was good stuff. And I liked watching Vince's interviews even before I knew him. So I had that familiarity with it. But my first job was in West Virginia. I went to Syracuse University, like a lot of sportscasters do. Never really thought about getting to the wrestling, but it is a good story because it shows you what happens sometimes when you work for nothing. And and I don't mean at the WWF, but prior to that, I was in, it was the summertime. I met a guy named Bruce Beck, who's a sportscaster in New York. Yep. I actually met him at a Syracuse football game, I should say. And he said, hey, next summer, we kind of talked about an internship. He gave me a name. And I ended up interning at Madison Square Garden Network a few years before I got the WWF job. One of the guys that I met there was the executive vice president of production, a guy named Phil Harmon, whose son David Harmon did a lot of HBO sports documentaries, was very well respected. And Phil was a great TV guy. He went over to work for Vince. So unbeknownst to me, when I'm going into the MSG once, you know, every morning on a train for no money, back and forth 5 days a week, and I didn't care about them. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I wasn't paid to do it. I went in happily and met a lot of people, including Rangers announcer Sam Rosen, and got to work with Mike McCarthy, who's now the head of the Marquee Network in Chicago, and so on. It was a great bunch of people to work. Unfortunately, there weren't a lot of events going on in the summer. MSG was before they got the Yankees. But my point is that I made a connection with Phil Harmon, and he winds up calling me my first job 11 months in West Virginia, and basically said, would you rather stay in Oak Hill, West Virginia, in the 143rd market in the country, or would you like to go to work for national television in the WWF? So I interviewed with Vince. I got the job.
What was the interview process like? Is it always here, like, he'll hand you a pencil, he'll hand you a broom, he'll do wacky stuff. I don't know if it's to test the person or to really test their sales skills, but what did he do to you when you interviewed with
him? No, I don't remember any of that. Remember, I had sent a tape. You'd already seen me professionally. I came under a good recommendation from Phil Harmon. So I think I was what he was looking for. And that maybe was somebody who was not out of the screaming wrestling world, if you will, but maybe more of a sportscaster type. Updates, I could do a little play-by-play if I had to, good writer, that kind of stuff. So I don't remember much about the interview other than sitting there and he was behind that big desk and it was very cordial. I don't remember it being very long, and I got the job.
What did you think about him, though, personality-wise, and did you get along with him?
I loved him. To me, he reminded me of I just played sports growing up. He was like a tough coach, incredibly brilliant. Remember then, they didn't have all the writers. There wasn't a tremendous support team. I'm sure they had people on the inner circle, Howard Finkels and so on, and his agents that helped work storyline structures. Maybe they did have a writer or two, or at least somebody who threw ideas at Basil DeVito was one of his right-hand men. But for the most part, it was Vince. And, you know, he could do every wrestler better than the wrestler could do himself. He was almost like the ultimate puppeteer. I worked pretty closely with him, especially on the TV tapings, being that I was the guy who was getting the voice out of whatever story it was. So I love working for him. And it was different when I worked for the XFL, which we could talk about later, but I enjoyed working with him every time I did.
But XFL though, well, I guess we'll stick on Vince since we're talking about, he wasn't as good as he was, or he's different.
No.
Or...
It was just that I was on like the third game, basically. I was on, I think it was TNN, and so Matt Viscurgeon was on the number one game, which was on NBC. He actually ended up getting replaced by Jim Ross.
Yeah.
So Matt goes to me maybe week two after week two. Hey, have you had McMahon yet on a game? And I said no, but I think we're going to get him in the Meadowlands in like week three. And which we did. And what I mean by that is he's on the headset in the truck and he's talking to you almost every other play. You know, tell me about this running back. Tell me about this. And it was a little much because I looked at Bob Golic. I said, is he talking to you like this too? You know, and he's. I will say this. I remember doing a game later in the year in San Francisco with Vince. And again, this goes to his perfectionist. He's trying to get his message across the way you saw it. It was a heck of an investment they made to try to do this. And they really did pull it off. It was a lot of the things they do there, now they do in the NFL. So although maybe it wasn't a financial success right off the bat, few ventures are. I think had they stayed within another year, they would have found some footing there because they were going in the right direction and they were innovative. Even to this day, I know they're coming up with some innovative things in the XFL. But when I was in San Francisco, did the game later in the season, it was much more normal. He knew we were prepared, and he didn't need to prod us to come up with storylines. Like I said, I like tough coaches. That's how I looked at him. I had a good rapport with him. I still do. I haven't seen him in a while, but I'm sure I'd get a good hug if I saw him. And I hope I do. I look back fondly. And to have you contact me all these years later and the interviews being run still to this day is kind of neat.
Yeah, very cool. Like looking back, and because that time period of WWF, I always call it the Hogan era, but you know, it's the golden era really of the WWF. Everybody remembers everybody from that time period. It is crazy. Like nowadays, yeah. 10 years can go by and I can't remember some, you know, even WrestleMania matches. I can't remember. Back then you can remember everything, everybody, right? Yeah. I mean, what an era.
Great theater. You know, there were so many great stories going on. And again, I didn't know everything other than Hogan and Savage. And I really had to get caught up on what was going on. I had watched it in the 70s, not as closely getting my career going and being at Syracuse and worried about SU football and what Dwayne Washington was going to be doing in hoops and all that. It was a quick learning for me, but it was easy to get because once you started watching it, you learned the characters. I knew the history of wrestling very well. So it didn't take a while for me to really catch on, but I wasn't an aficionado when I got in there.
So when you're being like an announcer, an interviewer and stuff, who is your boss? Is Vince your boss or is it like John Filippelli or who was the guy?
No, Filippelli wasn't there. I think he got there maybe my second year or right toward the end of my run there. Vince, yes, ultimate boss. You know, I would go at the time I was there, John, the production facility was in Owings Mills, Maryland. They didn't have the facility built in Connecticut. So usually once a week, I would go down to Maryland and we would do our special reports, updates, wrestling spotlight with Lord Alfred Hayes was the name of that. That was the third show they ran. And that's where the tapings were. Other times I would fly to wherever the wrestlers were to do these interviews that were a big part of the show back then. Personalized interviews, customized for whatever market they were going to. And that was always a crazy day. And then the TV tapings, obviously it would work under Vince. You know, it'd be a Superstars of Wrestling one night, Wrestling Challenge the next night, usually cities about 2 hours apart. It was a long night. They filmed probably for 4 or 5 hours by the time they get 3 one-hour shows out of there, by the time that they did all the interviews and the stand-ups and three different languages, and French and Spanish. So it was always neat. And obviously, Vince was on hand for all those.
Was Kevin Dunn there yet? I know he wasn't in charge, yes. But was he still? Oh, he was. Okay, what was
absolutely
his job back then?
Kerwin Silpies was our director. Kevin Dunn was in the truck. And I worked with him very closely.
What did you think about old KD?
Kevin Dunn?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was great. You know, he was a young man like all of us then. Yeah, he was great. Yeah, and he's still there. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. He's one of the big bosses now. Yeah, he's basically the number two guy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So it was great working with him. And he was in the truck with Kerwin Silpies, who was a very well-known director and very good. I mean, there was a guy named Ferd Manning who did the lighting. He was the same guy who would do the HBO lighting. And that was always neat coming in the ring, you know, at 10 o'clock in the morning to the arena, popping over there for some production meetings. And seeing Ferd Manning taking every light, and okay, that left, that right, and they go around the whole thing, and they had this, you know, it was a unique look in its day for wrestling. It wasn't the dark,
dingy,
the dark one
smoky
that the competitors had. It wasn't a small little gym or studio. It was a big, major sports building, and it was lit to perfection. The crowd was lit, and it, with spotlights, and it had a look, and and that was the guy who did it. So it was a neat business. It really was. It still is.
That versus sports, did you take it like the same and, you know, almost treat it as if it's real, quote unquote? And like, do you treat it like a sporting event when you're like an announcer or you treat it like it's a TV show?
I always kind of took umbrage with that real thing because these guys got hurt.
Big
it was
time.
Very physical. I don't know how they pulled it off because, man, it was impressive and very physical. Entertainment, yes, not like a baseball sporting event. Although, remember back in the day when I was there, there was still the rumor that it was like a sporting event. It wasn't till I think after I got out of there was some kind of a issue. I think in New Jersey, right, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And either to avoid taxes or some issue, I think Vince had come out and said it's sports entertainment.
Yeah, and the athletic commissions. Yep.
And the athletic commission and all that came out somewhere around there. So there was, like, for example, Bobby Heenan had a neck brace for something happened to him in the ring. And the funny thing was, for about 4 months, wherever he went, he had to wear that neck brace. If he went to get a pizza, if he was on a plane, wherever he was, outside of the wrestling ring, that neck brace was on. So the gimmick was, you know, kayfabe. Everything's on. You know, guys couldn't travel. At least they couldn't publicly. They tried to not publicly travel if they were, not that it didn't happen, but if they were adversaries, you know, they didn't want them to look like they were buddies back in the day.
Man, what did you think of Bobby the Brain? Because when you think about it, everyone that I talked to, everybody that was said, like, you know, smartest guy, quickest wit, but a bit of a wise ass, always cracking jokes. What did you think of the Brain?
You know, I was the young guy on the block there, so I totally respected what he did. And he was very cordial with me. I wouldn't say I was, you know, friends with him. I didn't have too many beers with him. I don't recall, maybe every now and then at the hotel bar. But he was a superstar. That's what he was. He was a superstar. He's probably the greatest manager of all time. Quick wit. Great with Gorilla Monsoon. Who's the better best. Than yep. a Gorilla? Bobby Heenan. You listen back to him to the day. He was funny. Maybe some of his stuff would be censored today because you can't get away with some of the material he had, unfortunately, because he was humorous. And he knew it. And, yes, very bright. And it's sad the way things ended for Bobby. Really just tragic. But he was the best. To me, he was the best manager of all time.
Totally, totally agree. Absolutely the best. And him and Gorilla were probably my favorite tandem as an announcer. I mean,
will you stop, John?
Will you be serious? Yeah. I used to love that. And then I guess nowadays, Gorilla might even get censored some of the stuff. Like, you can't say Pearl Harbor job and stuff like that. You can't say.
Yeah, well,
like
there was, you know, Chinese fire drill. You know, yeah, those are things they said years ago. But obviously nowadays we can't say that. There were a lot of, as you mentioned, you know, a couple of those lines. Things change. Culture changes. And obviously it's good that things do progress for sure.
When you look at it, though, it's one of those things where I love it. And you know, it was way different back then than it is now. I mean, they're not thinking anything along the lines of the way people think nowadays when they're saying some of the stuff they did. Some of that material is just great.
There were sayings of the day. I mean, everybody said those kind of things. I just saw Zippity Doo Day was removed from the Disney World. That song, you know, they were looking back and at different cultures and things change. And it's just a little more exaggerated today because of the attention in social media and what have you. But, you know, cultures improve, hopefully, and progress. And certain things that were okay 30, 40 years ago are not okay today. And there's nothing wrong with that. Just the way it is.
Splash Mountain. Yeah, it's going to be gone.
Yeah, crazy. Gone. Come on.
Crazy. After what, 50 years? Crazy.
To me, it was my favorite ride there. Disney was that drop on Splash Mountain. I know Space Mountain was popular.
Yeah, it was
Space. But to me, Splash Mountain with the Briar Rabbit or whatever it was and that song. So at least we have our memories.
Yeah. Actually took my son down there this summer because I knew Splash and a buddy of mine and his wife lived down there. We all went to Disney and my buddy's like, you know, this is the last time you're ever going to be on the ride. So I said to my son, I was like, they're getting rid of it. I don't know why, but but they are. But we had so much fun. It was awesome.
History in Orlando. Let's go to the videotape.
Yes. So as far as like WWF and that time period, you got to be thinking of, you know, Gorilla. You got to be thinking Bobby. But to me, as far as an announcer, Mean Gene Okerlund, how was he as a mentor for you? Did he take good care of you?
Absolutely. I really, really loved Gene Okerlund. He helped me get my name. This is not my real name, the name that you have up there. And he was, we said Heenan was the best color guy and maybe Gorilla was the best play-by-play guy. Nobody was a better interviewer than me and Gene Okerlund. He wasn't great on play-by-play, I didn't think. He would do some color or play-by-play. I don't think that was his forte, but nobody did an interview better ever than Gene Okerlund. He was the best. A character. His son was a hockey player. I've been a big hockey fan forever, so we would always talk about that. He's from Minnesota. And, he had a grace about him and a style. And, you know, he was very nice to me being the young guy. And I would basically do you know, it was me and Gene basically did all the interviews at the time, or Gene and I should say. And, you know, he was the best. I mean, he was, you know, there are some people in the business who are, would look at a younger guy coming up and maybe not be so forthcoming or so. Gene was the opposite. He couldn't have done more to help me. Where to go, what to do, whatever. And I remember the night, the first night I worked there was in the University of South Florida. They had a dome there. And I was only supposed to observe. And about 7 o'clock down the hallway, Gene Oakland yells, "Hey, kid," he goes, "the big guy wants you to do something tonight." I said, "All right, that's great." He said, "But one thing," he turned his head and I said, "What's that?" He said, "He wants you to change your name." I said, "What? When are we doing this?" "About 7:30. It's a half hour away." "Are you kidding? You know, change my name?"
Yeah.
This is not West Virginia. This is every market in the country. This is my name. You know, people spend months thinking about what they want to be called. And so he came over, and I remember like yesterday, we went literally, believe it or not, we went through a phone book like this. You know.
Yep.
Craig this, Craig Luna. How about Craig Luna? Craig, no. I couldn't come up. It was like 7:15. And I'm like, my mother's maiden name is DeGeorge. And that's where I came up. I also, in my middle name is Robert. In college, the first time I went on the air, I went on as Craig Roberts, which is a good TV name, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was my first thought, Craig Roberts. But Vince didn't want to do this. For what reason, John?
He didn't like ethnicities in the announcer's name? He wanted him to be generic?
Why didn't he want the name Craig Roberts?
Oh, because Jake the Snake Roberts.
Of course, okay. He had the snake. He didn't want another Roberts.
Yep.
So no Roberts. So I'm like, oh, God. I thought, because at first I'm thinking, okay, Roberts, great. Can't do Roberts. So I came up with my mother's maiden name. I remember calling the house up and said, "I may take your name either in this direction or that direction, but it's going to be my name, national television." And about a day later, I think I was in Baltimore on a house show. It just aired. I swear you, John, you could not have heard DaVinci say, "Let's go down to Craig DeGeorge." You couldn't even heard him. And some guy yells, "Are you Craig DeGeorge?" And I saw him in Baltimore. I'm like, oh, my God, what'd I get into? How would anybody know my name already?
Yep.
But, yeah.
So tell us about that, Jack. I know you mentioned before about Greenwich.
Yeah, well, off air I mentioned, but here it is. This is the actual jacket that I wore back on all those shows with Lord Alfred Hayes, with that colorful blue and the great. You know, nothing's better. It's a shame they had to change the name, in my opinion, and the logo. This logo is classic, and this was the jacket at Greenwich, Connecticut. I remember Vince said, "You know, what's your size?" And they sized me up, gave me two of these, one light blue, one dark blue. I wore it on almost all these shows, interviews. You saw all the guys wear it. The light blue just stands out to me and kept it in pretty good shape. I don't fit into it quite as well as I used to, but I'm proud to have it. I really should put it in a frame somewhere. It was a great look. We had this red tie and usually wore these yellow shirts and just neat stuff back in the day.
Probably worth something too. You put that in a frame, it'd be worth a ton.
Yeah, I don't think I'd ever want to get rid of it because it's maybe one of them. I have a dark blue one too, but I still have the tie somewhere too. So I like the memorabilia, you know?
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's a timepiece, you know? I mean, that's screams that era of the 80s of the WWF. It's awesome.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
So you got your name, you got everything down. What does Mean Gene tell you as far as like when you're recording stuff, like how to deal with each individual wrestler, or is that just chemistry with the guy and that's how you do it?
Yeah. You know, because everybody has their own style. And you know, I wasn't shy. I had my own style. I had worked on the air quite a bit, even though I was young. I was on the air every night in West Virginia and kind of learning the ropes of TV, but even in Syracuse, I did play by play. I did a lot of events. It was another event. It's just different sport. And you know, the worst mistake, John, I would have made is to try to be Mean Gene.
Yeah.
With his style, nobody could touch him. He did it his own way. I was more of a sportscaster. You know, I couldn't do, "He's 30, 40, 50, 60 feet above the ring." You know, Hacksaw Jim Duggan played his college football at SMU. And he took a pay cut to play for the Atlanta Falcons. Come on in. I mean, that was Mean Gene. You know, he was great. I was sort of a wise guy, young sportscaster type. Would get elbowed by Andre the Giant or snickered at by some of the other guys, or you know, I had my own thing, my own style, and it developed in the wrestling world. But it really wasn't a big transition overall for me. When I wrote a script, I had a kind of a way to do it. I put some cute lines in, and when I did like the wrestling update, which you can still see nowadays, or special report or updates. Lord Alfred Hayes and I had our own different chemistry together because I hosted a challenge with him. Later, I'd worked for the UWF. I did the Universal Wrestling under Herb Abrams. Did play-by-play on that with Bruno Sammartino, who I knew from the WWF, and most of the people that were in there I knew. And that was cool, too.
And a little bit of Captain Lou, right? I think Captain Lou.
Captain Lou, I did not get to know at WWF. Somehow we missed each other, but I got to know him very well at the UWF, and what a guy he was,
Man, these guys, like, when you think about it, what legends, like, in the business you're rubbing elbows with, you know, Andre and Bruno, I mean, all these, just crazy when you look back, right?
It's the timing of it, right? I happened to get there when wrestling was going like this. I got there for just before WrestleMania 3, where they drew 93,000, I think it was 379 or 179 to the Pontiac Silverdome. I was not on the broadcast because I had just gotten there. I remember I did I was there. In fact, I remember going up to the top and seeing the ring looked like, I don't know, maybe this. I went up to the top.
Yep.
What does the ring look like? Maybe.
Yeah, it's small. Yeah.
I mean, it was like, it's not a football field. It's not even a hockey rink. It's a wrestling ring. But I did this. George Michael used to have a Sports Machine show. And I remember I did about a 2.5 minute highlight package for the Sports Machine at WrestleMania 3. And then I was on the WrestleMania 4 broadcast.
Man, what a time. Hogan and Andre tearing it up.
George the Animal Steel, great guy. Mr. Fuji. You know, George Steel, I have a picture somewhere. I wish I had it here, but I just moved. I don't have all my pictures up. But anyway, we were taking a photo. And he put his hand behind my head like this. And he told the photographer to take the picture on 3. I'm looking at him like, all right, 3. I'm ready on 1, but okay, we can wait to 3. So, you know, 1, 2, 3. And on 3, he grabbed my hair and ripped it as hard as you could. Back.
Yeah.
So the picture's like this. And he's like this. He's in a suit and tie and everything. And people say, oh, you put it. No, there was no face. He yanked my hair as hard as he could.
He wanted to get the natural reaction.
Yeah. When I met Mr. Fuji, he had the cane. Oh, nice to meet you. He goes, puts his hand out like this. Nice to meet you. Takes his cane right at my crotch. What the hell are these people?
Miss guys that like was, that. Yeah, I love that.
Way to say, welcome to WWF.
Yeah.
He was
those
nice
were the days.
Yeah, really.
They're nice. All characters in real life, too. I mean, they're all real characters.
Absolute characters between CB and Afi and guys you forget sometimes, and Ricky Steamboat. And, you know, I love Randy Macho Man Savage. I got to know the lovely Elizabeth. You know, it was a great time. I'm really happy I had a chance to do it. I did at first wonder, you know, I'm a sportscaster going into the wrestling. Would that be a mistake, or would it take me down a different path? But it did. It was a lot of fun.
When you look at that era of WWF, we're talking about all these great guys, top guy, Hulk Hogan. What did you think about Hulk? Did you work with him a lot? Like, what was your reaction? And just maybe kind of going back and forth with the Hulkster.
John, I've been to every big sporting event you could ever be covered. Sports between Game 7 of a World Series, the Stanley Cup Final, the NBA, I don't think I ever covered the NBA Finals, but the Eastern Conference Finals, major soccer events, Orange Bowl, number one NCAA championships, everything you cover, and then some. And I will say that the entrance of Hulk Hogan into a ring with I'm a Real American playing is as bananas as it gets in any sports entertainment event ever. I mean, and this is back in the 80s where they didn't have as much going with lights and sound systems as they do now. electrifying. And they would always hold them for non-televised when they did the card, because they wanted the crowd to stay for the 3-hour production, the three different shows. And then he would be in what they call the dark match, mostly. He was not on the local Saturday afternoon show very often, other than an interview or a storyline. His match would be dark. I think the cameras were rolling, but they wouldn't do play-by-play on it. But the crowd was staying. You know, it might start 7, and Hogan comes out 11:20, and they're going nuts because they wanted to see him. When I remember working with them on these interviews I mentioned earlier, there were 3 interviews in every show that were, I believe, 2 minutes and 24 seconds. And it probably covered the next 2 months out, 3 months out, whatever the storyline was, for the shows. These are house shows. So if they were going to Springfield, Missouri in 6 weeks, they'd be cutting all these personalized interviews, or Springfield, Mass, or the Centrum in Worcester, or the Kiel Center in St. Louis, or whatever the place was. And I would go meet the guys on a house show, like in Phoenix, for example, fly out there. We'd be in a Holiday Inn in a room not much bigger than this one here. They put up that blue backdrop, lighting, camera. Usually Rene Goulet, I think, was that his name? Yes.
Yeah.
The great French Canadian wrestler, I think he was. A great guy. He was our kind of our checker. He'd sit on the side. And I would do interviews with these guys, and usually about 20 in a row with each guy. Maybe do 100 interviews in a day. And they put the card up on a piece of paper, and they would put that paper right under the camera, kind of right in the middle of the camera with a piece of tape. And it would say maybe like Madison Square Garden, May 5th, you know, 1987, and it have the card listed. And I would go down, okay, you know, be a Junkyard Dog will take on the Iron Sheik, and Nikolai Volkov and Boris Zukov will take on a team of the Saki, CB Daffy, and so on. And Hulk Hogan will be on the card. And then Hogan would come in, you know, brother, and do his bit. Now, Hogan liked to start out with small markets. So we would do Erie, Pennsylvania, Paducah, Kentucky area, you know, Topeka, Kansas. And after about 10, when he warmed up, he'd go, okay, brother, bring on New York. Because usually the card was the same. And so he warmed up with about 10 small markets. And then, you know, we're coming to Madison Square Garden. It was really cool how we did it, but it was a lot of work because you'd have to do all those interviews. And then probably in, you know, the markets where you're not going to do a live show for 3 or 4 months, then they would run a generic interview.
So was he larger than life, like to you, as he was to everybody on TV?
Yes. Yeah, I remember we did a Coliseum video on a small kind of speedboat, if you will, in the Long Island Sound. It's still out there. Hulkamania was maybe one of the first ones he did. And I did the interview with him. So I was sitting, you know, on the back of a seat. I was sitting on the, like there's two rows, right? There's a regular seat and then it went flat. So we were both kind of sitting on the flat part of the seat in the back next to each other. I'm next to him. And before we rolled, he goes, oh, brother. Yeah. He says, could you go down on that? Like, you want me to sit? Like on the scene itself, not on the top. Yeah. All right. So it was, you would never do it. Now I'm like this, you know, it's like me doing this to you. Hi, John.
Yeah.
You know, I'm first of all, the guy's 6'6", I'm 5'10", right? He's 320, I'm 160. Now I got to go down, you know, 3 more feet and, you know, do this interview. My neck is like this, you know. But, you know, he was a perfectionist. Remember when Vince would shoot Andre the Giant, the camera wasn't high, it was low. Like the old show, Land of the Giants, the camera shots were to make you larger than life. Yep. And I guess that's what Hogan thought in that interview.
Did you get along with him? Like you're doing the shoot?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, we got along well. You know, I didn't pal around with him. There were some guys I did. But yes, he was always very nice to me. And I ended up seeing him on my mother turned 80 some years ago, and we were on a Carnival cruise, and of all things, Hogan and his family were on the same cruise. Wow. We were shooting that show, and, you know, he said hello, we talked, and yeah, he remembered me.
Awesome. Look at that. Yeah. Hanging out with the Hulkster on the cruise. That's great.
Yeah.
Who were some of the guys you hung out with?
One of my favorites was Johnny Valiant, the late Johnny Valiant, luscious Johnny V. He was a nice guy, really nice guy. I actually, after his wrestling career, he was a very funny man, and my brother's a stand-up comedian. And we got Johnny out to do some shows at my brother's comedy club out on Long Island, where a lot of guys like Kevin James started, Eddie Murphy, and so on. And also, Nikolai Volkoff was a good friend. And I would drive him, usually him and Johnny V, to whatever city, like we were for the second taping. So if we were at Superstars, next morning, wake up at the hotel, and we drive 2 hours somewhere, I usually drove both of them. I remember going into a, it was like a brat type place in somewhere outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Me with Johnny V and his blonde hair and Nikolai Volkoff in this maroon suit with yellow striping for like 10 in the morning. We walk in, everybody was like, what? Nick just walked in here, you know? So, and I brought Nikolai, I think, as a recall to a Syracuse University broadcast class once, or a couple of guys, as I remember. You know, the obviously Gene, we would hang out with, and in the bars sometimes you'd see the other guys, but good bunch of guys.
Did you party and like drink with the guys and stuff, or did that not really kind of stay separate as far as that life?
Yeah, you know, I would say on a mild social level, a beer or two, not out all night, not some of those stories. No, I wasn't in that, and I wasn't on the so-called inner circle. Although I was, in wrestling terms, you know, I was one of the guys, but not on that kind of level. Yeah, no.
You mentioned doing the Hulkamania thing, and, you know, going out there in the boat and stuff. What were some of your other like favorite shoots that you did as far as like going on location and kind of, you know, going outside the norm?
Well, the one I could think of that I'll never forget was superstar Billy Graham making his return from hip surgery.
Yeah.
So he actually had his hips. I think it was both of them, both sides, I should say. I believe it was both sides. He had them repaired. Vince shot, and this is 1987-ish, they shot the actual surgery, the real surgery. You see the things going in, blood. Somehow they put it on a Saturday morning. In some markets, I believe they censored it after it aired in like the East. I don't think it aired in the West. Because it was, yeah, they had a graphic up. But so what we did, we went out to Phoenix, Arizona, where superstar Billy Graham lived. And we did his 8-week recovery. But as you know, TV can be expensive. So we had to shoot his 8-week recovery in just one day. So this was probably, I don't know, 6 to 9 months after he had the surgery. Now on TV, it looked like it was the next week. So week one, we go in the gym. He could barely press the weights. You know, I cut, put a couple more weights on. By the time we were done, he had 24 weights on there, 10, 10, and 4 on the top. And I believe only 200 pounds were actual weights. The rest had talc on them and looked like real weights, but they weren't. Had it been real weights, it would have been, I think, 1,200 pounds. But it was about 200 pounds, and that was week 8. So we did all that. Then we went out to the mountain. You know, and he'd fall a couple of times. Cut. All right, that was week one and so on. And, no, I don't need any help to Georgia.
Yeah.
But it was great. It was like 100 degrees sweltering in the Squaw Peak Mountains or whatever they call those in Arizona. And, there were a lot of shoots like that. That was a fun one.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool. And superstar, that return was huge. Obviously, didn't really kind of last because
it was short lived, right?
Yeah, because legit injuries. Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Well, yeah, that hip thing, but it was when he came back. You know, a lot of people feel that Hulk Hogan took a lot of his act from superstar Billy Graham. He was a personality as well with that music. Jesus Christ Superstar would play. Yep. He would come in and he was maybe one of the originators of that music and theatrics. Before Hogan.
No doubt, because if Bob Backlund doesn't come along and have a superstar with that long title run, who knows what happens to Hulkamania? Because you almost have that very similar guy. I don't know if it quite
put Bob, he wasn't as, he was a superstar in his own right, but he wasn't as theatric.
No, but I mean, like Backlund kind of took his spot. He beat superstar Billy Graham and he becomes the guy.
Yes.
Billy Graham kind of could have got that whole run and beat Backlund, you know what I mean? And just kept that run going.
Absolutely. Yeah. But when Hogan came along with the tan, the look, the handlebar mustache, and Vince had seen him, and I think he was in the Minnesota. He was in that area, I believe.
AWA.
In the Midwest, Vince knew what he was. Vince knew he had a star. You know, Vince had an eye for talent, and obviously much of it is not just the in the ring, but the on camera, and you know, you look back and you see how great he was and Savage. And I saw this documentary on Jake Roberts the other night. It was incredible. I didn't know half the stuff. And Jake was one of the best, you know, one of the best heels of all time. That's an understatement. He was amazing.
Never yelled either.
He was very cool and collective. He had that snake. You had to watch that snake too, because if you turn your head behind the scenes, Damien might be on you. He used to chase Iron Mike Sharp all over the place with that thing. And all of a sudden you see Mike Sharp, big guy, you know, 300 pounds, Canadian champion, running for his life because of that snake. Yeah, but you're right. He had a different way about him. And he had a lot of things that went on in his past that I watched in this documentary. And I think that helped play into the persona that he had as Jake the Snake Roberts. Remember, he didn't have the snake when he had that name earlier. It was Vince who added the snake in there. And it was, and he'd take the snake and put it on people afterward. And it was creepy and crawly. And, you know, he had this one with Savage where they were going to create some kind of a Savage Jake Roberts feud. And Savage said this, you know, he's going to have the snake bite him in a pretty well-known little clip these days in the ring that night. But Savage, according to Jake, insisted in the afternoon that the snake bite Jake first to prove it wasn't poisonous. And he's like, brother, you never know what they're going to do around here. You know, so he's got to bite you. And if he bites you, then he can bite me. Jake thought Savage was crazy. But apparently he did that. And I guess, and I didn't even know this, but I assumed that they could take out the poisonous part, obviously, of the venom somehow, so that the bite, while it hurt, it wouldn't obviously kill you or even injure you to, you know, where you'd be hospitalized. Yep. But Savage didn't believe until he had, apparently, I didn't know this then, but Jake tells the story that snake bit Roberts in the afternoon. And he's like, you sick mother, you know what? And so then that night, Jake didn't almost let up. He had that snake really dig in to Randy Savage in the ring.
And that thing wouldn't let go either. Wouldn't let go of Macho Man's arm.
No, it didn't let go, no.
They devenomized the snake.
Devenomized. That's right.
Yeah. Yep.
That's right.
How was Macho?
Oh, brother, I love working with him. First of all, we used to talk a lot of baseball because he was a Triple-A player.
Yeah.
And he was always really, really respectful of me. I think he liked me, I would say. We got along really well. He was one of my favorites. And Elizabeth also. I remember we were in Boston Garden, and then we were in a small room, and Elizabeth was showing me how to put makeup on my eyes. And, you know, to this day, when you put your makeup on sometimes, and you get that look in TV, we wear makeup, of course, the raccoon look. And I remember Elizabeth saying, no, no, no. She's so sweet. She was like, you take it? No, she didn't. She just showed me in her eyes, and then I did in mine. You know, you'd put it like this. And he was incredibly protective of her, too. Incredibly. Like, you wouldn't believe it. You know, if anybody came here, he'd be running around. And it's a sad story for the two of them, what happened. Her dying in the situation with, was it Luger?
Yes.
Drug overdose. And in his situation where I assume that it was a heart attack that caused the crash, the single car crash that he had in Florida. And I think he was only 61 or 2 maybe. But one of the great, right? I mean, all-time greats. He's right up there with Hogan. And, you know, in a smaller stature. But from a theatrical standpoint and an athlete, that he was way better than Hogan. Yep. There aren't many better than him.
I always say, if you wanted
whole
the perfect...
package.
Yep. Whole package, perfect wrestler, it's him.
Maybe the whole package, he's number one.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally agree. Because the look, the athleticism, the in-ring stuff, the promos.
Doing interviews like this, and spinning, and, you know, and everybody can impersonate him, you know?
Yep.
It was incredible. Yeah. so sad about Lanny Poffo, who I saw maybe a year or two ago. And he, you know, the poet laureate passed away recently. Yeah.
Yeah, and he was in great shape. He was the night before. He was in New York City at some Broadway show, living it up. Crazy.
He had a nice wife, I know. He had, a nice life in his retirement from at least, you know, active wrestling. Yeah, very sad.
So was anybody else playing pranks on you besides Jake the Snake? And I know Fuji a little bit and George Animal Steel, but anybody else playing jokes on you?
I remember once Andre the Giant got me. It wasn't a prank. It was a real elbow. We were doing an interview at the Spectrum. What happened, John, back in the day was they would do shows once a month at the Spectrum, Madison Square Garden, and the Boston Garden. And they would televise those locally only.
Yeah, so, MSG, Prism, and Nesson. Yep.
There it was. Very good, John. You're good. You got a Villanova shirt on. Is that right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Looks like the Villanova V.
Yeah, so no, it is. Yeah, my wife's cousin went there. Yep.
Went there, Villanova. Okay, so I would do the color on a lot of these, not the garden shows, the ones in Boston and the ones in, I would do play-by-play or color depending on who was there. Because usually the guy that did the play-by-play was a local guy, like at Prism, it was this guy, Dick Graham. I mean, fans, don't you love it? Don't you really love it? Oh, he was an FM DJ. Didn't know anything about what was going on in wrestling. But he was a regular on Prism. He would do the matches. So I would do the color to provide the storylines, what's going on, here's what's coming up, well, that's what, and do all that. I didn't break down the moves per se, but I gave the WWF a voice of what was going on currently, and he was the play-by-play guy. And I would do the interviews after all the matches there on Prism. So I did one with Andre once just to the left of the ring, and Andre had a way of pausing, and I'm holding the mic up, and I'm waiting. I thought he was done, and he wasn't done, actually. I had my right arm, I remember, because he put my right arm down like that, and then he said, I'm not finished talking yet. Grabbed the mic back, and boom. Elbow right to the gut. You ever gotten an elbow from Andre the Giant?
No, never.
Yeah, I was like, ugh. But it was one of those. I actually lost my breath for a second, but it made for good TV. But it wasn't planned, I can tell you that.
Was he legitimately pissed or just messing with you?
You know, like we said earlier, John, everybody's on, and if the TV hotshot here wants to take the mic away from Andre the Giant, he's going to pay the price because that's what, you know, that's what Andre the Giant would do.
Yep.
So, you know, it's there's acting, there's storylines, there's characters. And I think it was in the nature of who Andre the Giant was that he would not just be politely saying, Mr. Craig, DeGeorge, I'm not, you know, that was, you know, that's what he would do. No, it was just a reaction. You know, I can remember do-si-do-ing with, you know, and I'm not much of a dancer, with Hillbilly Jim on live, and you know, like, or you know, Ron Bass with that Miss Betsy. You know, you had to get out of the way, jumping off stages, you know, in interviews when things were going haywire, all that stuff.
So, what do you leave in 1988? I guess you end up leaving.
I did basically 2 years there. Yeah, 88, 89.
So basically two of like the biggest years, really. I mean, they were on fire those years. So why did you end up leaving?
Well, it was they had brought in the guy that brought me in and left. They brought in another guy. And it happens a lot in TV where the other, you know, you're not the guy that they brought in. And so they actually replaced me. I was kind of shocked. I thought, to be honest with you, I thought I would be staying there a lot longer. But it got me back to my sportscasting roots, which probably was a good thing in the long run. But it would have been fun to have been around there a little longer. And then I ended up, because I was in wrestling, you know, in such a visible role, I ended up doing the UWF. I ended up, Hiro Matsuda was a great Japanese wrestler. He would do a card in Tampa. Actually, we usually did it. I did it with Oliver Humperdinck. It was on videotape. It was wrestling from like Japan and against like an American wrestler. And we would go in every 2 months or so and do the play-by-play.
Wow, very cool. Who ended up replacing you? Sean Mooney, I guess it was, in the
WWF? Yeah, it was Sean Mooney.
Any sort of relationship with him or no?
I did his podcast not too long ago.
Oh, yeah, nice.
I don't recall if we overlapped for a month or a week or whatever, but yeah, I didn't really know him that well. But I did his podcast. You know, I've gotten over the years, I gotten to know him a little bit, but at the time I didn't really know him. I replaced Ken Resnick.
Yes.
Who was on before me, and he replaced me. There's not a lot of longevity in these sideline guys if you were not Mean Gene Okerlund.
Yeah, it doesn't exactly. Seem
like it's like they get tired of you after 2 years.
Like they always want to switch. Even today, with like, they use a lot of different people today, and they switched them. Yep.
Yeah, but I'm happy to say, though, when I watch those interviews and people send them to me, that they hold up. They stand the test of time. And it's nice that they get replayed and people see it.
Who's your favorite interview that you've done? I know you mentioned a couple guys like Macho Man, but who's like the favorite?
Boy, they were so good. They were all good. You know, from an excitement standpoint, probably Hogan, just because he was Hogan. Not that you did a lot, right? But when I had a Hogan interview, and we did the interview on a podium in the crowd, you know, so you got 18,000, everybody's watching you. There's nothing more exciting than that music playing, and he's coming in, and you're introducing him. You know, he hits the ring, and the place is going nuts. You know, what match is that? Nothing. But in terms of the interview itself, you know, Randy Savage, and these interviews that we did at for these local shows that you don't remember because you never saw them again, you know, a lot of them were really funny. And I don't remember every little bit and piece of them, but I remember that you never knew what was going to come up because it was all ad lib, you know, about a certain city or take a shot at the city or this or fans or whatever. But the reason these guys were so good is they were great on camera, and it made it very difficult really to go back into the sports world because most of the guys in the sports world are not great on camera. They don't have to be great on camera. They have to be great on the field. But to be a great wrestler, you really have to bring something to the table when the camera's on and you're promoting yourself or the card or the WWF. And they did it better than anybody, you know, better than all these athletes. They knew they had to do it. And it made their business. It made them more money. Whereas today, when you interview athletes, they make enough money, much of it because of the media and how big they become because of the publicity and the gambling and all that. But they don't need you the way wrestlers, we were on the same team. You know, I'm trying to get them over, right? That's my ultimate job, is to get them over and get the message out in a sportscaster way and let them do their shtick. So they were great.
When you look at the time in wrestling, did you like being the announcer at ringside? Did you like being the color guy? Did you like being the interviewer? Did you like doing the Coliseum stuff? Did you like doing wrestling spotlight? Like, what was your favorite part of the job?
My favorite part was probably going to those TV tapings every 3 weeks because it was exciting. And most of those I would do an interview or do some of the wrestling updates and what have you were taped previously. I did only a little play-by-play. I would do most of these dark matches, couple. And I wasn't the greatest wrestling play-by-play guy. I was okay, but you couldn't really do it the same way you would do. Let's put it this way. It's a bigger transition to do wrestling play-by-play from other sports than it was to do interviews or whatever, because the role is similar. In wrestling, they didn't really have a history in terms of a win-loss record or, you know, where they grew up. Or, you know, there was it's not part of the story, right? It would take away if you talked about, oh, he grew up, you know, no, you don't do it in a baseball game. You might, hockey game, you might, but not in wrestling. So I probably would say the interview role was my most favorite, which probably, ironically, would be my least favorite to some degree in what I do now. I'd rather be talking about games, breaking down games, than doing an interview, unless it's after the game. I like the after the game where you're really picking apart something that's going on.
When you look at Herb Abrams, I know you said you saw the Jake the Snake doc. Did you end up seeing, I think it was last year or the year before, there was a Herb Abrams documentary.
I missed it. I'm dying to see it.
I think it might be on YouTube. But his story is nuts. Like, is he really that nuts? Or, I mean, did they play it accurately?
No, he was crazy. He was really nuts. He was crazy. I remember, like, he couldn't touch the door handle. He'd have to clean the door handle of a car. No perfume. You could not wear perfume. If a woman wore perfume, they could not wear perfume around him. But he was a likable guy too. I, you know, he was very nice to me. Although he didn't pay me for my last show. Can I get that? somehow. Oh. John, you got any connections?
I hope so. I'll try, yeah.
Yeah, but I would go in there in the UWF and do the show in New York, and it was, it was at the Penta Hotel. And then we did a pay-per-view, which no one probably thought, called the Beach Brawl.
Yeah.
Down in Florida somewhere. I think we were in Bradenton. It was actually a pretty good show, but I don't think anybody watched it, unfortunately.
I got a couple of those VHS tapes.
The worst part for me was when the Boogie Woogie Man kissed me on the lips. First of all,
why the hell did he do that?
Who knows? He came over, he's doing something. He said hello, and he was about 150 pounds, tattooed. He was kind of like, not that it would have made that much of a difference, but when you're sitting there and the guy kisses you, it wasn't a romantic. It was just, he's just being a wild knucklehead.
Yeah.
Yep. It wasn't anything like that, but it was, you think of bad memories, that's probably one of them.
Yeah. That'll do it for you. How the heck did Herb have money, though? Because he brought in Andre the Giant. He brought in Bruno. Where did
everybody
get money from?
I don't know. I think he had a successful, was he a jeweler? Garment business?
Maybe yes. Yes, I think it was Coach and Garment.
New York. So he was basically a fan that became a promoter. Tremendous. And he was able to hook up and convince the people at Sports Channel to put it on so it was national. So I think it was on Sports Channel America back in the day, which was later the NHL Network. So it aired everywhere. And I guess they brought in some, they had big names. Cactus Jack was there.
Mr. Wonderful.
Mr. Wonderful. I mean, he had just about everybody who was on the back end of the WWF, to come over. And Bruno was the color man with me and Lou Albano. And, it was quite the George. I love the way Lou Albano was quite the George.
Did you like UWF as much as you like WWF?
It was fun because actually I got into the role of play-by-play there, which is all I did. And while I said at WWF, I really because I only did a couple here and there. I never really got in a groove.
Right.
But I felt like I got better at it doing it at the UWF because that's all I did. I would go in and do the whole show. And I was working with Bruno, who I knew, and I knew all the wrestlers, and I was a little more accustomed to the sport as well. I remember one time, though, they had the ring collapsed, like the middle of the ring just caved in like that, dipped. And they were trying to work around it, still doing, falls.
Oh, my God.
It was not big time, even though it was on big time television. But it was a professional production. They had cameras and good lighting and all that. But it wasn't a WWF.
It's amazing to me that everybody remembers you. Like you said, it was only 2 years in WWF and sometime in the UWF. It's crazy. Everybody remembers you. There'll be guys on TV nowadays for like 10 years, and you don't even remember who they are or what they did or can't remember their names. Why do you think that is? Is that just that was the best period in wrestling, and then everybody remembers it so fondly?
I think that's a lot of it. I think it's the people that I was able to work with. The interviews became sort of classics. All of them were great. They were well-defined characters, and they were also – they were almost pop culture characters. Like everybody knew those guys. Randy Savage was on commercials, and Hogan, and they were. And also, it had a little more of a family feel to it, even though it was wrestling. Your 7-year-old would watch it, and your 80-year-old grandfather would watch it. Yep. And now it's become a little more adult in nature. Not as much. I know they went through that period in the 90s, where, and really 2000s, where it was almost R-rated. But there was there was an attraction to it. I wish my kids had were around then to be able to watch wrestling back in the day. I think it was better. It had a little more innocence to it. It was just getting going with kind of taking a new path of storylines and characters and these larger than life characters became dolls at Toys R Us that you would buy. Just like Vince said to his father when he was younger that someday, G.I. Joe, they're going to have wrestling dolls. And his father looked at him like he was crazy. And it became big, so I think that was a big part of it, the culture and the characters that these guys were. And I happened to be having a good seat. I was right next to him doing the interviews at the time. And then to have it relive, which you wouldn't expect then, and to be re-aired where these interviews pop up. I have this 80s wrestling or somebody sends me like stuff and I can almost remember the line before I see it. And I haven't seen it in 30 years. Because of the time. I think it has to do with, as you mentioned, it was just taken off. WrestleMania 3 and 4 were as big as it gets almost. And I was there for with the front row seat.
Utterly just an amazing, amazing time in the business. But as we wind it down, head towards the finish, how do you want like fans to remember you when they think of Craig DeGeorge? Even if it's sports career, WWF, everything, how do you want like people to remember you? Like if, you know, the stamp you're leaving behind, like how do you want to be remembered?
You know, I hope I'm not that old yet, but but I get, you know, I hope somebody had a good time who enjoyed what he did, who brought passion to it, and also who knew his role and didn't try to over. There's a lot of guys sometimes that come on. I was watching a host last night, and he's working on a major sports show with big celebs, and he just kept talking. You know, it's not about you. You know, the host's job is to set up the people you work with and make them better. Yes, you can get your personality. Yes, you can have your take. And if it's only you, you can put your stamp on it. But your ultimate job is to like a good wrestler, get the other guy over. And if you do that and take a sort of a humble role, you know, I think you did your job. And especially when you got characters like this, you didn't have a crazy guy be the interview guy. Now there's a talent to it. I'm not saying that. And there's a knack and a touch and a feel with the camera that people feel comfortable with you. But I gave it to him straight, like a sportscaster would, and with some fun. I would needle the guys a little bit too, in the way I can do. And I had a good time doing it, and I worked for some great people.
So what's next for you? What do you got on the docket?
Getting ready for baseball season, John. It's my 21st or second year with the Marlins. I got a big schedule coming up. I do some hockey. I'll do hockey this week. I did some college basketball in December, and always wanted to do a game show too. That's always been a dream. So hopefully I'll get that going. I got some ideas in the fall. But yeah, baseball's up next. I went up to spring training a couple of times, and I'm going skiing next week, which I'm looking forward to.
Nice. Very, very cool. And of course you got big autograph signing coming up, right? 80s Con.
Oh, we got a huge May show in New Jersey. Up. It's May 5th, May 6th. I beg your pardon. In New Jersey. It's going to be a huge show. I didn't bring all the details, John. I think you have some of them, but it's a big show. 80s wrestling, Northern New Jersey. Tell you what, Tommy, the promoter there, does an unbelievable job. He opened up a store in New Jersey, a little south of Newark, about 20, 30 minutes south of Newark. And I think he's having a who's who of wrestlers. I'm going to try and bring that jacket, lose a couple of pounds, and wear that jacket. It's going to be a great event. I'll be there with a lot of familiar faces. And it's May 6th. So check the wrestling storylines and Twitter and what have you for more details. I don't know if you have them in front of you, but it's coming up May 6th. It's going to be a big day.
80s wrestling everywhere. If you go Instagram, Twitter, I mean, yes. It's everywhere. If you go to Google it. I mean, it's awesome. And 80s Wrestling Con, of course, too.
Right.
Bret Hart's going to be there. Very rare. Be there. Beverly Brothers, which is pretty rare. They're going to be there, which is pretty good. Cool.
Yes, it's going to be great to see unfortunately, there's a lot of guys who aren't with us anymore. It's hard to believe, yeah. You know, and so they'll be there in memory with us, but it's going to be a great event. And it's great that these 80s wrestlers, you know, many of them have stayed into the public right till today. You know, Bret the Hitman Hart are still banging it and doing a good job out there and occasionally even getting in the ring or being around the sport.
Yeah, it is amazing. But Craig, where can everybody get you, social media and otherwise?
I'm at Craig Minervini on Twitter, and I'm at Craig_Minervini on Instagram.
All right. Awesome. Well, Craig, thank you so much for all the time.
Yeah, Minervini, that's my real name.
yeah, of course.
But it's not to George. Craig DeGeorge for a day or two. Thanks, John.
Yes. But Craig, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You could follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You could check us out on Facebook. You could subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website, TMPTEmpire.com. And buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother.